This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have some additional bills up this evening, and if we don't finish all of these this afternoon, we would have to postpone them or continue them in the evening. We're going to start with Senator Rest's bill, the Home Care Tax Credit, Senate File 696. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, whoops, what did I do? What fell on the floor? Anything important?
I don't think so.
On there?
Just cords.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, I do have an additional handout. Get a page.
And Senator Rest, you have a delete everything amendment as well?
That's correct.
Senator Erickson Ropes moves the A1 delete everything amendment, which is in the packets. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The Senate File 696 proposes a home care income tax credit of $200 a month, not to exceed $2,400 in any given year. One of the things that we have, I think, been focusing on in health care policy is the number of people that are taking care of relatives and family members, husbands, wives, whatever, in their own homes and making a financial sacrifice to do that because they are not compensated in any way. And what this bill does is to recognize that. It's also by giving a tax credit to those who meet certain income guidelines and also caregiver guidelines. And there's been a program in a New England state, and I want to say that it's New Hampshire, but it might be Vermont. I sometimes get those confused, where they have gone to a program of supporting family members who are taking care of people who would otherwise need long-term care and doing it either in their own home or in the recipient of a caregiver's home, and have found that people tend to thrive under that and also at a much lower cost than it would be if these recipients of the health care, long-term health care, would be in a nursing home situation. So this bill then establishes this $200 a month, and it is a refundable tax credit, which means, and I know this isn't the tax committee, but it does mean that if someone is not paying taxes, that they would still get this money. It's just like the working family credit, for example. It's a refundable credit rather than just reducing tax liability to zero. So in the delete everything amendment, which you were kind enough to adopt, the first part of that in section one is an addition to the long-term care consultation team's responsibility with regard to applicants for a credit in this section of 290, which is the income tax statutes. They have to, the caregiver, the services that are there have to qualify as PCA services under the statute that is referenced. The care has to be needed and provided in person on a daily basis and judged to be by that long-term care consultation team likely to either delay or avoid transferring the person to an out-of-home placement. The income eligibility is based on the same schedule that we use currently for the homeowner's property tax refund and the renter's credit schedule. So it is very definitely means-tested. There are some people who whose income is low enough that they already get government services, There are some people whose income is so high that they don't need additional help. And these, this particular tax credit is for those, for many of us who are caught in the middle, but want to give care either to a family member who is has long-term disability and needs daily care, or indeed frail and elderly parents, for example, who otherwise would not be able to live totally independently, and instead would be forced into a very expensive nursing home care. Mr. Chairman, I passed out information from the Alzheimer's Association, which supports this bill, a fact sheet about family caregiving, and we have some people who would like to testify in support of it.
Do you want to call your own witnesses in whatever order you wish? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself, and then you begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I'm Joan Molinar. My husband, Larry Molinar, whom I give care to, is sitting right behind me with a red plaid. We're here in support of 696, a real short synopsis. He's had MS since, we know for sure, since the early 70s, because I was able to take care of him. He was able to work an extra 12 to 14 years because at a time when he couldn't drive or ride the bus anymore, I drove him to and from work and to and from all his appointments and provided his activities to get ready for work and at night. Now it's, since he was disabled, retired in 95, it has progressed to I give him total care, and it takes 5 to 6 hours at least minimum during the daytime and then nighttime activities whenever they're needed. We have enough, he has enough retirement income that we don't qualify for any assistance or for coming in the home, but we don't have enough to afford to hire. We are at a stage in life with living very frugally, we have done. We still don't always, most months, meet in the middle, the proverbial middle of the month when you run out of money. I tried in the last 12 to 15 months to find some kind of part-time job for maybe 3 hours a day. By rights, and I wasn't able to because most employers will hire part-time, but they like you to work at a six-hour shift or eight-hour shift, and to be fair to them, as an employer, they have to have certain production. It would also be unfair because on any given day, it may take 3 hours instead of 2.5 hours to do the morning routines. And so I would be calling and saying, I'm sorry, I have to come in late. Or I'd get a phone call, oh, I'm sorry, I have to run, he's sick, needs extra attention. Or I'm sorry, he has an emergency medical appointment. So in all fairness to the employers, they need somebody who's dependable. So I am unemployed. I am employed full-time as a giving all the PCA care, but not licensed as a PCA person. This would help us make things stretch a little bit more and meet a lot of the costs that we pay out of pocket for medical care. Granted, we have some insurance, but we still have co-pays and you name it just on regular day-to-day and month-to-month. So I appreciate having an opportunity to share our little short story. I appreciate the effort by the our elected officials to provide this possible opportunity for families who give care to their loved ones, whether it's a child or a spouse. Thanks for your time. Joan Molinar, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Molinar. Questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. Go ahead. Just please identify yourself as you begin.
Chairman Marty and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 696. My name is Karen Eileen. I'm a member of AARP Grassroots Election Advocacy Team. A growing number of older persons and adults with disabilities across our state are receiving care informally by family members. In fact, unpaid family members provide 80 to 90% of the long-term care provided in our society. These family caregivers are often juggling multiple roles at home and in the labor force. To better recognize the needs of family caregivers and the tremendous financial sacrifice that they make to take care of their loved ones, AARP urges you to adopt Senate File 696, legislation to provide tax credits to informal family caregivers. A number of years ago, my mother had cancer, and I cared for her. As a nurse and as a daughter, she deserved my best. I became her primary caregiver, and because of my situation, I worked part-time for a while, but as you heard from the previous testifier, the demands are very heavy, and eventually I quit my job to care for her. An estimated 9% of caregivers quit their jobs to provide care. AARP estimates that nearly 1 in 4 U.S. households are involved in caring for a relative or friend age 50 and older. A recent study by the National Alliance for Caregivers estimates that family caregivers suffer a financial loss over their lifetime equal to more than $650,000 in lost wages, pensions, and Social Security benefits. The study's findings also suggest that 2/3 of people providing care for elderly relatives make significant work sacrifices. Caring costs our business community as well, and according to a 1997 MetLife study, approximately $29 billion was lost to business each year in this country from lost productivity. It is certainly cost-effective to provide a small but significant tax credit that will enable families to continue to provide that best care for their loved ones in the home. This tax credit would have been beneficial to me while I was caring for my mom and other family members. Without family caregivers, the responsibility for caring for our loved ones will fall more heavily onto government and on an already financially stressed long-term care system. When my mother needed my care and my help, there wasn't another consideration. There would always be another job. I had one mother. Additionally, as a nurse, I gave my best care to my patients. That same best care needs to be available to our loved ones as well. I urge you to pass this legislation to better recognize the significant sacrifice made by family caregivers all over our state. A brief mention that this is the symbol from AARP this year. Care for the caregivers is our slogan. On the other side, our letters, AARP. It can be a little stress reliever if there's any in your life. On a personal note, if this legislation could help care for me or anybody in this room as we move along the journey of life, again, personally, we should be so lucky. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Eileen. Questions from the committee? If not, Senator Rest, that's the end of your witnesses. Is there anybody who wished to testify with concerns about the bill? Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I don't have any quarrel with the goal of your bill here, but I must just express some concern that I have that the county long-term care consultation team, if this were to become law, would probably be overwhelmed with people asking to have an evaluation and asking to have the care that's being given certified as being eligible for this tax credit. And our counties are really losing federal funding right and left these days, and they tend to be under a lot of financial stress. So I'm assuming you don't intend to have funding for the counties to do these consultations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I didn't hear your last sentence. I'm sorry.
I'm assuming the bill is not asking for money for the counties to do the consultations, and therefore I have some concern.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I actually share those concerns, and one of the things that will happen when we get the revenue estimate, I think we will be getting an estimate of based on how many people might be eligible for this, and we need to look at the degree of extra burden on the counties to make sure that it is not an overburden. Keeping in mind that this is not for those of means, and it is not for those who already are receiving government assistance for being taken care of at home. It is cutting a swath among people who have limited incomes that, as we've just heard, they would be able to meet in the middle of the month and still make it to the end of the month. And that is the group of folks we're looking at. And we don't exactly know until we see the revenue estimate and how many people they are going to assume that's going to be. At that point, we'll have a better idea of what the total fiscal impact is, independent of just what the tax expenditure is.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I just wanted to raise the concern because after bills leave here, we never know where they go or what happens to them. And I might not be on those other committees
with the committees, if it acts favorably, the bill would go first to the tax committee at least.
Further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 696 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Members. Senator Fischbach, are you ready with your bill?
Yep.
Senator Fischbach, you have this 0318 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to offer that as an author's amendment. It says AO7-0318.
Okay, and I believe people now have that. Is there this author's amendment? Senator Fischbach moves AO7-0318. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. Senate File 1215 is an agency bill, and so I'm going to turn it over to the department for them to explain the technicalities of it.
Thank you, Senator Fischbach. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, the Environmental Health Division, and with me also is Janet.
I'm Janet Olstead. I'm with the Department of Health, Community and Family Health Division.
And what we have before you is a housekeeping bill that touches on a number of different programs within the health department, and I will just step through the various sections of that bill. The first section has to do with the radioactive materials program. When the radioactive material fees were revised in 2004, the Minnesota Department of Health meant to delete language concerning renewal of licensees. That cost is already included in an annual fee for licensees. So the obsolete language is meant to be deleted or removed from the statute. The cost was actually incorporated into the annual fee, and in the end, this becomes revenue neutral. Section 2 has to do with the X-ray program. In 1996, the fees were established as biennial fees. And this language is meant to change that to an annual fee and to eliminate fee for sources of radium, which are being collected under the radioactive materials program. The issue with the biennial fee is that it causes confusion with the regulated community, leading to frequent overpayment by industry, and causing us to either issue refunds or return payment and fee to them. This should aid also the facilities in budgeting for paying those fees. Again, this is meant to be revenue neutral. Section 3 also deals with the X-ray program. It's meant to remove the requirements for exams for qualifying X-ray operators to incorporate darkroom and film processing. It's not that that will not be part of exams, but currently, as it is in the statute, we aren't able to vary that. And as part of that, a lot of the equipment is embracing new technology, such as digital images. Section 4 through 7 has to deal with the lead swab team grant language. This is a program that was transferred to the Department of Health from the Department of Education in 2005. The grant process, as it currently is cumbersome, and these sections are meant to streamline the process. Section 4 deals with definitions within that grant process, expanding eligible organization, as well as eliminating the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency as identifying the commissioner within that grant program. Section 5 is meant to simplify the process by which we go through to provide that funding out. It eliminates basically a work group that we're required to use to determine who's eligible to use that grant funding. And Section 6 is basically reducing some of the criteria, again, to streamline the process for providing that money out to grant recipients. Section 7, again, is a simplification for the process. Within Section 8, there are a number of repealers. One in particular, just to step through them, has to deal with the prorated collection of the biennial fee for X-ray registration. Another one has to do with burdensome language to the veterinary community. There's a requirement there for personal monitoring that is more stringent than the current health department and national rules. By removing this language, they're still required to do personal monitoring, but only for those individuals that are likely to be exposed. And some of the remaining sections that are meant to be repealed, again, go back to the lead swab team grant language in order to help streamline that process. In addition, there's a portion that Janet will comment on.
The Community and Family Health is requesting repeal of 144-146, treatment of cystic fibrosis. The funding for that particular program was eliminated in 2003, and we inadvertently did not repeal this language at that time.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I assume there's nobody from the audience who wished to speak with concerns about the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill if there's nothing. I'll move Senator 1215.
Senator Fischbach moves it. Senate file 1215 as amended be recommended to pass, and I believe because the amendment has to go to state and local.
Yes, sir.
On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Why don't we take, is Senator Pretner so is not ready yet for hers yet?
I'm ready.
Oh, you are?
Okay.
Oh, Senator Higgins, okay.
If you want me to be done with it. If
Sure. But if there's somebody else, go right ahead around me.
I'm not ready for mine quite yet.
Kind of. Everybody else is on the committee.
Okay, well, I think everybody else is on the committee. If Senator Higgins, if you want to take yours up, that would be fine. Higgins, Senate File 570.
Mr. Chair, let me start out with the A, I assume, one amendment. Yes, is an office amendment.
The A1 amendment, which I believe is in the packets. Is it in the packets?
Were these in the packets?
596.
Senate File 570, the A1 amendment.
Making sure it's in the packets. Is there any discussion of the author's A1 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 570 includes provisions to address a number of issues that have come up in the context of providing non-emergency medical transportation for MA clients. These are the rides that people need to get to their doctor's appointments or dialysis treatments, things like that. There have been a number of issues raised in the last 2 years regarding the operation of this system. You will recall that we fundamentally changed things a few years ago when the department sought to have bids submitted to broker this particular ride service. There have been a significant number of issues that have cropped up with respect to connecting with the ride center. There have also been questions raised about the level of need determinations that have been made by the broker. Some of the clients who are eligible for this special transportation service are ambulatory, and some are wheelchair patients. It's important to get the level of need right, and if you don't, inadequate service will be provided, and there will be increased risk to this vulnerable population. There's also an issue of how long, or related to the level of need determinations and how often they need to be made. Currently, these determinations are being made by the broker for virtually every ride. This bill would say that we need to make the determinations twice a year, but no more. If you're paraplegic, for example, this week, you're going to be paraplegic next week as well, and you just don't need to keep making that level of need determination over and over and over again. Finally, there are provisions to increase rates for this particular service. This industry hasn't seen increases for many years, and in fact, they have volunteered to accept reductions in rates as part of their years-long strategy to forestall certain of the brokered elements of this program. Mr. Chair, we have witnesses here to talk about the service, and I know they would like to testify.
If you want to call your witnesses as you're ready.
Start with your name.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jan Roars. I own and operate a rural special transportation company for the past 15 years. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Medical Transportation Coalition. This is a group made up of the Special Transportation Services Association, the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association, the Minnesota Ambulance Association, the Minnesota Paramedic Association, the Minnesota Emergency Services Association. The current bill is also supported by numerous hospitals, organizations, and the Minnesota Hospital Association. As you may note in the audience, are additional providers, social workers, dispatchers, nurses, billers, health unit coordinators, and most importantly, our customers, the individuals most affected by the multitude of serious problems that have arisen due to the implementation of the broker into the medical transportation area. It is our sincere hope that by bringing these issues to your attention, we will be able to salvage this seriously damaged industry. My job today is to give you a brief overview of the situation in which the non-emergency transportation field finds itself today. The booklet that you have received highlights some of these issues. The Department of Human Services asserts that by implementing the use of the brokered system, they have saved millions of dollars for the state on transportation. As you can see from the graph on the on my right, which is also in section one of your booklet, the reality is that the only savings that can be shown are a direct result of industry initiatives. In 2004, for example, the industry working with DHS brought about changes that resulted in $5.4 million in savings through chain of custody documents and DHS employees enforcing eligibility rules. This was accomplished before the broker system even was put into place. Again, in fiscal year 2006, the industry took a $2.4 million per year rate cut in an effort to provide time for DHS to realize the problems with the current ATS brokered system and not expand it into the STS transportation as well. In fiscal year 2007, the rate cut remained in place, even though the broker was expanded into the STS transportation sector. Contrary to DHS assertions, once the broker was implemented, not only have there been no savings, but costs have actually been on the rise. Since the broker has been involved in the medical transportation sector, several serious problems have emerged. One of the most common problems is downcoding of patients. Basically, what this means is that a person who requires special transportation, STS, is downcoded to the lesser level taxi transport, ATS. This means that instead of a highly trained and certified driver with a fully inspected vehicle picking up a person and checking them in at their destination, a taxi cab picks them up at the curb and drops them off at the curb. The broker has deemed this person doesn't need assistance, even in some cases where the person is in a wheelchair or has Alzheimer's disease. This puts the passenger at risk, makes the broker more money, and provides lower payouts to transportation providers and saves the state no money at all. The example photos that are in front of us here speak for themselves. Electric wheelchairs do not work in a taxi, and these are people that the broker has classified as ATS. Section 3 in the booklet that you have is a collection of ride orders that show passenger after passenger classified as special transportation by the state system and yet sent out as an ATS ride by the broker dispatcher. Worse yet, that sample is only 1 week's worth of downcoded rides for one single transportation provider. I would like to take just a minute to quote the general counsel for the current broker, Mr. Donald Tymeyer, when he appeared in front of the St. Louis Taxicab Commission on January 19, 2006. He recognized that the medical transportation field is totally different and distinct from taxicabs, and he said that, quote, the needs of the people who are being transported are totally different than the customer who calls a taxicab. We fully agree with Mr. Tymeyer. It is our hope that this bill is passed and qualified drivers return to providing medical transportation trips to those who need this service. Another problem facing transportation providers is the common practice of the broker shorting mileage on ride orders sent out. Section 4 of the booklet shows a few examples of different mileages certified by the broker for the same trip, just different days. Once again, the state pays the broker the same amount, so no savings occur to the state when the broker shorts a provider mileage, but again, the broker just makes greater profit. I have focused on a couple policy items since this is, after all, a policy committee. But I would also like to bring to your attention that this bill also includes a rate increase. Surely I don't need to point out that the hardship all providers have been facing in dealing with escalating fuel, insurance, and other costs. Rural providers have had an especially hard time with the huge number of unreimbursed deadhead miles that are a part of out-state transportation. The current number in the bills are placeholders. The actual numbers will need to be worked out in the Finance Committee. With this rate increase, we are hoping to be able to keep the current network of quality providers alive. Chairman Marty and committee members, I sincerely appreciate your time and attention to this topic that is so near and dear to my heart. If after hearing the testimony you have any questions, there are numerous providers, medical personnel, and passengers that are happy to speak further.
Thank you, Ms. Roars. Is Senator Higgins?
Okay.
Please identify yourself
Mr.
and
Chairman,
go ahead.
Hi, My name is Ingrid Korf.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Ingrid Korf. I supervise the social workers at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale. We have approximately 17 social workers in the hospital on a daily basis, and they have between 15 and 20 cases. They work specifically with patients in the hospital, and one of the functions is a discharge planning function. And the social services staff at North Memorial Medical Center have experienced innumerable problematic experiences with the services provided at MTM. We have concerns about the safe transfer of vulnerable patients to their next level of care or to their home. Vendors are inexperienced, not available at specific time, and the communication between the MTM staff and their vendors is really quite dismal. I'll give you a few examples. On December 15th of 06, a social worker phoned MTM for wheelchair transport with oxygen and indicated to the MTM staff that the driver would need to come to the floor to pick up the patient. Originally, the ride was scheduled for 4 p.m. This ride was then changed to 2:30 at the request of the social worker. It was one of those Fridays where we needed to move patients out in order to create some relief for those patients waiting in the emergency department. The social worker reiterated the need for the wheelchair transport and the patient would have oxygen. Furthermore, she indicated that because of the oxygen, the driver needed to come to the floor to pick up the patient. MTM arranged the ride, and meanwhile, the social worker left the floor to do other tasks and arrived back on the floor, finding the patient waiting at 3:10. The social worker called Mobility Solutions to ask where the driver was. The social worker was told by Mobility Solutions that the driver had been in the discharge waiting area for 10 minutes, already 30 minutes late. The nurse on the medical floor contacted the hospital escort service, and when they arrived, the social worker accompanied the patient to the discharge area too. It is not our usual practice, but she felt some responsibility in ensuring that the transfer went well. The social worker found the driver still waiting, but he had not brought a wheelchair. The driver did not know about the need for the wheelchair. The driver said he needed to go back to the office and get one, maintaining that the office was about 7 minutes away. The social worker stayed with the patient in the discharge area. Again, not our usual practice. The driver was still not back at 4:00. The social worker then phoned the dispatcher and asked again where the driver was. The social worker was told that they did not have any wheelchairs available at their office. He was waiting for another van to come back to the office. The social worker phoned her supervisor, me, at about 4:10 and was directed to take the patient back to his room and the patient because the patient was complaining that he was hungry and tired of sitting in his wheelchair for over 2 hours. The social worker phoned MTM to describe the situation and left instructions at the discharge waiting area for the driver to come to the medical unit. And this was from one of the social workers who works on a complex medical care unit. So the patient was fairly medically compromised. My second example also happened in December. The patient was discharging to Robbinsdale Rehab and needed a wheelchair transport. The first call to MTM was told that he needed a wheelchair, and MTM set up a ride for pickup at 1:30 p.m. At 2:30, there was still no driver, so the social worker called the transportation company. The transportation company stated they did not have a van with a wheelchair lift, and then they stated they didn't know it was a wheelchair transport. The social worker called MTM a second time and spoke to the supervisor. He rescheduled the transport with another company. The third call to the supervisor of MTM indicated that the driver arrived 30 minutes late and again without a wheelchair. The fourth call to the MTM supervisor explained that the driver had come back with the wheelchair, but the wheelchair had no arms. The driver then left to get the arms. The driver returned to the hospital, but refused to transfer the patient into the wheelchair and threatened to leave. Hospital staff got the patient into the wheelchair, and they did leave. Another example happened in January of 07. MTM was unable to accommodate a patient needing a wide wheelchair. They wanted to drive to the patient's house and get her wheelchair and then come to the hospital to transport her to the nursing home. The patient refused for obvious reasons, so they directed the social worker to call LifeLink for a stretcher transport, and LifeLink refused to take the wheelchair patient in a stretcher van for that reason. The fourth incident occurred in January as well. A patient required wheelchair transport to the nursing home with oxygen. And this was a hospice patient. The MTM was informed that the patient would have her own oxygen for this transport. After the transportation provider picked up the patient's nurse shared the following safety concerns. The transportation personnel did not know how to safely transfer the patient from the bed to the wheelchair. The transportation personnel was unfamiliar with providing transport for someone using oxygen and, quote, would not touch it, unquote. Usually the transport personnel are able to leave the floor with the patients. However, the hospice nurse accompanied the patient and the transportation personnel to the van waiting in the discharge area. She wanted to ensure that the patient entered the van safely and that oxygen was administered correctly. Again, I have a number of other examples that I could share, and I have those for you if for later, but at this point I'd like to end with this statement from our social work staff. The social work staff at North Memorial Medical Center contend that they've experienced unqualified help who are unreliable and in the end, unable to do the job in a safe and timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark.
Hello, Chairman Marty and Senators. My name is David Watson. I'm the Director of Care Integration at Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. I supervise the social workers in our hospital. With me today also are several social workers and health unit coordinators from our hospital who have experienced many of the exact same things that the social workers at North Memorial have. A couple other things that I would like to add to it is the amount of time our staff spend for hours waiting for MNET to give us a response to finding a ride. The health unit coordinators and social workers can deal with this for 3, 4, 5, up to 8 hours a day trying to find transportation for one patient. Methodist Hospital typically discharges approximately 30 to 40 patients per day who need a wheelchair transport. Our emergency center has another 2 to 8 per day. And the amount of patients that are held up from leaving the hospital because of the waits can be quite dramatic. We have patients who have to wait in the emergency center and wait to be admitted to the hospital because we don't have beds available for them. We have had similar experiences where the wheelchair transports show up with no wheelchair, or they do not have a wheelchair large enough for the patient needing transport. They have shown up without being able to transport oxygen, though we have told them we have patients who need to go with oxygen. We had another example where actually one of the nursing homes we work very closely with in St. Louis Park called us to complain because of the fact that the patient arrived at their front door walking, because they were told to leave the vehicle by the driver, and carrying their possessions with them, rather than being escorted into the building in the wheelchair that they'd been transported in. A final example that I have for them is our concern in Methodist Hospital for just the safety of our patients. I think the last example I gave spoke to that, as well as the fact that most of the transport companies show up with no kind of identification at all. We don't know who these people are, yet they're here telling us they're going to transport someone's loved one home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Higgins, do you have more witnesses? Mr. questions?
I have a big voice.
That's okay. So do I.
Welcome to the
committee. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Hewitt. I'm the business development specialist for LifeLink 3. I've also been an EMT for the last 20 years of my life. LifeLink 3 is an interesting bug in the world because we're consortium owned by the following hospitals and clinics: Fairview, Regions, the Children's Hospitals, Hennepin County, Alina, and St. Cloud Centricare. We operate airplanes, helicopters, ground ambulances, and yes, special transportation vehicles. One of the problems that has been burdening our company in the last year or so has been our hospitals that we service having an issue with throughput and flow. Very simply, what throughput and flow is when you're admitted to the hospital and when you're discharged from the hospital. Every little thing that happens in the hospital affects that, from the time you come into the ED to the time you leave. If a person cannot get off a general medicine floor by a wheelchair transport, the person in the ED cannot go to the floor. And what this has caused in some of our member hospitals is the big word that all of us hate to hear is divert. And what does divert mean? When I'm driving my ambulance and I have a cardiac patient in the back, I may have to go down the road 5 to 10 minutes away. This is a big issue, and it's starting to happen more and more. What the brokering system has done for us is basically slowed up the process of throughput and flow. If the HUCs have to sit on the floor for 20 minutes waiting to talk to the broker to move these patients, it's a big issue because it impedes that patient from going to the floor that's in the ED or moving this patient out to the nursing home or to home. To keep it real simple, we have a plumbing problem and we have to fix it. I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. Questions from the committee?
Thank you. And we have one more.
One more, okay.
Hello, Commissioner and committee. My name is Marie O'Connor. I'm a mother of a disabled child who just had reconstructive surgery of both limbs, lower extremities, and when she was first discharged from the hospital, things went smoothly because she was stretcher. And once that changed to wheelchair, things got totally messed up. On one incident, they sent out a van that was not handicapped equipped. The driver did not speak English, and I canceled the appointment, and I told him to go. He didn't understand. He knocked at the door again, and I said, "It's been canceled. Go." 5 minutes later, he called me on the phone and said, "I'm sitting out front." And I said, "It has been canceled. You can't transport her safely." And on other occasions, I have a list of dates. It's all started on January 20th. I started setting up a whole month's worth of appointments that she needed to go for rehab and that. And I called me in to set up the appointments. They took all the information, the times and dates, and I never got a phone call letting me know that everything was set to go and what time pickup would be. So I called Health East, who we did all the stretcher transfers with, and I asked them if they received the orders, and the dispatcher said, "Yes, we did," and we also called them back and told them we didn't have anything available. So I called Mintran back, and I spoke to the same person again, and he said very clearly, "Everything is set. It's all in order. Just call and get the time for pickup." So then I called him back. I got the same dispatcher, and she said, "I've told them there's nothing here available." And I said, "Well, he said he refaxed it." And she goes, "Well, that's kind of redundant. If we don't have any rigs available, why would he refax the order?" And she said, "Call him back one more time and inform him that there was nothing available." So I did that. And she also did tell me to tell him that if he had a problem, he should call her. And he put me on hold. He called the dispatch person, and he came back on the line, and he said, "No one's answering the phone." And I went, "Well, they're an ambulance service. They have to answer the phone." And he said, "Well, nobody answered the phone." So I called the dispatch person back, talked to the same dispatch person, and she didn't know what to do, so she just did some jiggling around, got us in. And one of my things is I need someone who knows how to deal with disabilities because she has a seizure disorder, too. That's why I specifically asked for Health East to do the transfers because there's times when people, when she was in the hospital, there were some nurses that didn't even know what her seizures were. She went into seizures for 2 hours long. And I really need somebody that knows what they're doing to pick her up. If I say move over or pull over, we have an emergency situation here, they need to understand that I know what I'm talking about.
Thank you very much, Ms. O'Connor. Sorry to hear that. Is there questions from the committee? Senator Higgins, you're done with your witnesses?
I think we're done with our witnesses.
One question, and the language at the top of page 2, which I think you amended, I just wanted to... the broker also does, right now they deal with reimbursement for, it says for public transportation passes, volunteer and recipient mileage and parking reimbursement. I have a constituent who contacted me who I'm assuming would be covered under the recipient mileage, so I'm assuming is not affected by your bill. But I was just curious because she had said about how things were fine until the firm came in charge of things, and she said in July of 2004 when the firm came into business, it got more complicated or so and frustrated. You're supposed to call before each appointment to get approval. It sometimes took 15 minutes. She says her daughter goes to therapy twice a week, so she's spending a lot of time on the phone, and they were not always polite, et cetera, et cetera. Then she said there were a few annoyances about reimbursement process. On some days, I get 5 or 6 checks in the mail for as little as $1.60, up to perhaps $9 each with a stamp on them. Since we heard they made the switch to save money, I couldn't figure out how that was happening with such an inefficient system. However, I noticed they were figuring the mileage on the low side. You might be reimbursed for 8 miles on a trip when it's actually 10 miles. And I figured that's how they were saving money, et cetera. And then she said, I think this is last October, she began to notice substantially more charges than there used to be that never appeared there. For many, there were 2 charges on a single day, one for $2.40 for the appointment, and that was the amount for which we were reimbursed. The other charge for $8.78, which did not go to us. So they were having similar kinds of frustration, but I'm assuming your bill isn't really touching those because that's reimbursing the person who's eligible now. Mr. Hewitt? Or?
Right. There we go, thanks.
Chairman Marty and members of the committee, Michael Widener. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association. Senator Marty, you are correct that this bill does not address that issue. If you may recall, we've been before this committee numerous times to eliminate the broker, and what happens is the fiscal note is so large by the Department of Human Services, and so that's why this is just limiting. The broker would remain doing that because the only way to eliminate that would be to eliminate the broker, and the fiscal note, again, is extremely high from the department.
It's frustrating to get fiscal note that's higher when money seems to be going out the door faster than ever on that. But I mean, this woman said she said they used the simple form in the past. She said that they'd send her a form every month. She'd fill out right in the dates and the times and how much mileage was, and at the end of the month they'd send her a new form and send her a reimbursement check, and she started getting it ride by ride, and she was saying she couldn't figure out how that would save anybody any money.
Right, and Senator Marty, what would happen then if that was removed? What would happen is the person would then go back to working with the county to get her reimbursement. That's how it used to be. I know I've talked with Representative Mador. She has a number of constituents who have complained that very same thing to her, and so we're trying to find some way to address that issue. But without having a fiscal note yet from the department on anything, we can't really actually solve the problem the way we'd like.
Okay. So that's the next step.
Hopefully it can be something that can be addressed in the finance department.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
And I noticed that there are some more members at the table who were here when we first started this bill. If you'd look at this book that was prepared under tab 4, one of the things that's really irritating is that, you know, on one day your ride to dialysis, for example, might be 10 miles, and another day you get reimbursed for 7. Going to the same place. And if you look through here, there are even examples on the same page where going to dialysis one day it's 9.7 miles, the next is 6.6. A gentleman named Eugene went to the purple building at HCMC, and one day it's 10.3 miles, and the next day it's 7 miles. Now, they don't move the building around, and yet, you know, they're just really...
Mr. Chair.
I'll be polite and say odd things going on here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, this is nothing against your bill, but that's the one piece that I do understand because I have a built-in navigation system, and it's never the same. So if they're using any kind of an internet program, even when you're typing, and I noticed your bill says to use the quickest. Let me tell you, my husband and I have found that that doesn't always mean that it really is the quickest. It's just what a computer came up with. So actually, that's the one part I do understand. If they're plugging it into a computer, they're getting a different route. They're getting a different number of miles. So, and that's not defending this program because let me tell you, I'm with you. I don't like it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator... Senator Wergen, but if you plug it into the computer, you know, one of the things that's supposed to happen is it's supposed to come back the same way.
It doesn't.
Time after time.
It doesn't.
And, yeah. It also sometimes will take you in routes that nobody in his right mind would ever go. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's also the reason that it's the bill says the quickest. Because the quickest between, the shortest distance between Minneapolis and St. Paul may be Lake Street. But... that's not the way you're going to drive it. You're going to drive it 94. So that is why it says quickest. Senator Wergen.
Except during rush hour.
Yes. Other questions for
Mr.
the witnesses?
Chair?
Senator Wergen.
My in-car navigation changes quickest every time, too.
Technology is a wonderful thing. Yes. Mr. Chair, I know that the department wants to come and testify against my bill.
Yes,
they have issues, they say.
Welcome to the department, and unless there are any other questions for the witnesses. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Corrin.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't know that the different departments are supposed to take positions on anything. Aren't we the ones that are the huh?
They do.
I mean, aren't we the policy makers here, or? So they're steering us in the direction that they want us to go. Is that right, Mr. Chair?
They are. We let them come and testify when they
okay.
want to testify. Sometimes we ask them to come testify.
Okay. I don't know that I necessarily want to hear their testimony, but I guess if they want to give it, that's fine.
Maybe they're not here. I don't know.
Somebody from the department.
Sure enough. Hello.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Reisdorf from the Department of Human Services, and I do want to speak about some concerns that we do have with the bill. As you may or may not know, the amendment that takes away our authority to broker for special transportation services. Special transportation services are the highest level of transportation services that are provided. This is a service for someone who requires a transport to go into their home, take them out into the vehicle, help them into the vehicle, and then take them to the desk of the medical appointment. So it is something that is very complex, and there are people who need that service. MTM makes appointments for about 75,000 trips on a monthly basis. So that's a quite large number of trips that MTM does schedule. And the number of trips that MTM has scheduled has increased over the past several years, plus years that they have been brokering transportation services for us. I just wanted to go over a few of our concerns that we have if our ability to broker special transportation services specifically goes away. We, by any means, we do not think that all transportation providers provide poor service, but there are some. And so those are the areas that we want to have an ability to manage. We have found over the past few years that our surveillance unit has made over 200 audits of special transportation companies and have found a number of things that have happened that will, our ability to manage those issues will go away if we cannot broker for special transportation services. Examples of those are claiming more miles than actually provided, transporting to places other than medical appointments, transporting to places where transportation is included in the rate, and by the first day that MTM brokered the STS services, we found a company that was transporting people to a service that where transportation was involved or included in that service. So that was a $50,000 savings on a yearly basis right off the bat. Also, other things of improper billing that have been found are billing for trips that never took place, billing multiple trips when a single trip was needed. The contract that we have with MTM does actually afford us some very positive things, and we can use the contract with MTM and their contract with transporters to ensure proper equipment. I think there have been some issues that have come up where the transporters have not had the proper equipment, where our contract with MTM offers us the ability to strengthen the contracts that MTM has with those transporters and make sure that people have the equipment that they need. We have, MTM does, we require that they list all of the complaints that come in to them on a monthly basis. And there are some complaints that come in about clients themselves. There are some complaints that come in about the services that MTM provides. Quite honestly, there have been some issues and concerns that have happened because of the brokering of this service. But the vast majority of complaints that come in are about the transporters themselves, that transporters aren't taking people into the clinic desk. We're hearing that quite often, where someone has the level of need that requires the station-to-station transport, but the transportation company is not taking them to the desk, that vehicles are not marked, there's no identification of the drivers, that they're showing up late or they're not showing up at all. All of these things are things that can be managed through a contract with MTM and a transportation company. Other things that would be lost, MTM does have staff that speaks five different languages, and so that is something that would be lost for people who are seeking STS services. Also, we through the contract, we were able to pay providers more based on the cost of gas. And so we are paying providers more as the cost of gas has gone up. That adjustment, we call it the FAR, the fuel adjustment reimbursement, would be gone if the brokering of special transportation was gone. I also want to comment on the level of need. Not every ride, a level of need is not done on every ride. There were some concerns about the amount of level of needs that weren't being done, but our contract that went into place in July of 06 mandated that MTM use the Social Security guidelines for level of needs. So now level of needs are being done anywhere from 1 to 7 years. People are certified for STS rides. Right now, there are about 1,000 level of need certifications that are done on a quarterly basis, out of about over 200,000 rides that are being done on a quarterly basis. The bill also says that we will not be able to do level of need for nursing home or stretcher trips. Right now, we are considering everyone in a nursing home to need STS level of service, just because the vast majority of people in nursing homes obviously do. But we do know that there are some people in nursing homes who do not require that level of need, of that highest level of trip. And so this would kind of hamper us in moving forward in the future in making sure that people in nursing homes have the most adequate and appropriate level of transportation. If we would are not able to do a level of need for stretcher, this is the most expensive level of trip. And so it's critical that we are able to do a level of need for stretcher transportation. And I just wanted to mention that with the hospital discharge issue, we have made arrangements so that with hospitals, that any hospital who has a person who needs to be discharged, they can go ahead and call the transportation company directly. They do not have to go through MTM, and MTM will pay those trips retroactively. So if hospitals took advantage of that process that has been in place ever since MTM took over the brokering of STS services, there shouldn't be a problem there. Hospitals can call the transportation companies directly. They do not have to go through MTM for those services.
Mr. Chairman.
Just a second, Senator Coring. I wanted to get back to one thing you said about you're hearing from the company that the complaints, you're not hearing that many from the recipients of the rides. And I think I might suggest that maybe the DHS should take the complaints itself, because I had one, my constituency, I called DHS to inquire about this. I remember explaining it to someone, being on hold for a long time, then the person returned said someone would have to get back to me. Never heard from them. And I heard from several others that they were actually, the calls were forwarded to Missouri and the people there were not helpful and so on. So I wonder if maybe the company who you're dealing with is telling you, oh, we're not having a lot of complaints, because I frankly think I heard when you said that you're not hearing complaints from people, I heard some snickers in the audience. I don't know that that's proof of anything. But I think I'm hearing from people, and I think the witness said that another state representative was getting complaints from people with similar things. And I just wonder if maybe getting the complaints yourself, you might be hearing what's on people's minds, because at least this one constituent of mine, again, it's a very small sample, but so they called the department and were just dismissed out of hand. And your point about the complexity of the service, and these are high-level services, and they're not always ready. Well, it seems all the testimony was saying that the problem now is the new firm is not, the brokering firm is sending out the people who are not equipped for it. It seems the brokering firm is causing more problems than the businesses they were designed to broker the business with. What's with that?
Mr. Chair, I may have misspoke. I did not mean to say that there weren't any complaints. What I meant to say is that we keep tabs of complaints, but most of the complaints come into the MTM office, and when we receive complaints, we will deal with them, but we also send those complaints to MTM so that we have a total of the complaints that have come in on a monthly basis. So of the complaints that come in, about 70% of the complaints, or the complaints are from people who are being taken on the rides. And so we do hear a lot of complaints from our recipients or patients. And the complaints that are received go from some, about 10% complaints about the clients themselves. So there are some transportation companies who are telling us about some clients who may have some complaints about them. There's about 20% of the complaints that are about MTM itself, and about 70% of the complaints are about the transportation companies themselves. Prior to the broker, there was not really a method or a mechanism for recipients to complain about trips, complain about companies that didn't show up on time or didn't show up or were rude or other kinds of things. Now there is a phone number that they can call, and we are hearing about some scenarios that are disturbing to us. And like I said, not all transportation companies are, I mean, there are transportation companies that are providing extremely good service, but there are some that are not. And so we are concerned about those companies that are not. And so this contract with their complaint line and their ability to work with companies offer us that kind of ability that we did not have before to deal with those companies directly and to talk to them about the complaints that come in.
I do wonder if a lot of the people who you're saying are now complaining would have complained before, but they weren't having the problem, and now you've got a firm who's sending the inappropriate transit service. And that's why they're complaining now, and the complaints are coming up now because they weren't happening before. At least that's what I was hearing from the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, we did receive complaints before. But
I'm sure there are some. I'm just saying that maybe the reason for some of the increase is not just because there's a phone number to call, because the woman who was talking about transporting her daughter and the problems, she strikes me as the kind of person who would have complained before if she had the problem. And it's not that she just came now because she found a phone number that came out. So, but Senator, Mr. Widener, did you have...
Your Honor.
Your Honor. No, that's later on.
Got to go to law school first.
Senator Marty, if I could just address one of the, sort of to follow up on what you were talking about. You talk about the list of complaints and whether complaints were happening before or not. Our concern, and what is lost in this whole process, are the people that we transport. And prior to the broker coming in, if a transportation company did not provide quality service, that rider did not contact that transportation company again. So what happened is the complaint mechanism was the freedom of choice, the freedom of a patient to choose who would transport them and how they would be treated. The problem you have now is patients do not have that choice. They do not have the choice. What happens is the broker sends whoever the broker wants to send, and the transportation company is not invested with the patient. The transportation company, the client, is not the patient anymore for the transportation company. It is this broker. And we think that these complaints could be resolved by eliminating the dispatching portion of what the broker does, and that's what this bill does, and letting people choose who should take them, and that will solve this complaint issue. If I could also just address a couple things. I have to say that I am very dismayed by the statements that the department continually makes about fraud or about improper billings. And I just want to say that we have met with the department for the last 3 years, and we have said, use some sort of standardized, computerized mileage system. We have offered that up and said, use something so you have a standard so that people are only billing for the miles that are approved. Now, the department has never done that. They still have not accepted that as their policy. The other thing is we met with the department, the industry met with the department, and we said, here's something that we think will save the state money. And what it was, it's called the chain of custody document. It means that when I pick somebody up from the nursing home and I take them to the doctor's office, the doctor signs for that person. It does two things. One, it makes sure that these people with disabilities actually make it to their appointment. And second, it makes sure they have an appointment. So people are only going to services that they actually have an appointment for. You will notice on the chart to my right, by doing that in 1 year, and also by the department enforcing its own rules, determining who was actually eligible, the department had 2.5 staff people, and they finally started saying, you know what? You're not eligible for this service. In doing those two things, we saved the state. We saved $6 million in 1 year. That's actual money that we saved. And so now that this broker has come around, the chain of custody document is gone. You no longer need that. You know, that prevented people from going to unauthorized services. The other thing that's happening is the broker is now sending people to day treatment centers, to churches. You know, what we get across our desk. That's what these transportation providers see, going to unapproved services. That's what's happening with the brokered system. I think that's wrong. My clients, my association thinks that's wrong. And so what we're asking for is to go back to some sort of accountability where the people have freedom of choice and providers go back to a chain of custody document.
Senator Coring, then Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chairman, I would yield to Senator Wergen. She wants to speak. So.
Thank you, Wergen. Mr. Chair. I leaned over and said we had our hands up at the same time. You better not be first. So.
I'm sorry, I did not see your hand.
Once in a while, we got to do those things in here. Mr. Chair and members and Senator Higgins, I like about 90% of your bill, I'll be frank, and I'll try and keep this short. I think we did get here because of abuses by some of the transfer systems. I really do believe that. Maybe not you, maybe not anyone that's standing here today, but there were abuses. I think we all know that. I saw them. Okay? And so we got to a system. We tried to eliminate something that was kind of going wrong, but I happen to think we went to something that's going even more wrong. Mm-hmm. With the broker in place, we really have had some problems, and I think more than we did before. Maybe we're saving some money, but sometimes you got to say at what cost. And in this particular case, I don't know. And it might be anecdotal, but I think everyone at this table knows that when we are out knocking on doors, we hear the standard but important issues like my taxes are too high and the roads need to be fixed and the kids need good school. We hear those things over and over and over at the doors, and they're very important. But I think it's pretty rare that at a front door people engage us in conversations about something like this issue. And I came at this summer not having known much about it before, because at three different doors in one campaign season, people kept me in very lengthy conversations about this issue. The first one, and I'm going to admit this, so forgive me out there, you guys that do this. The first one was someone that does patient transport, and I thought, oh, here we have a territorial issue. Please don't take my business away, and please don't make me lose any money. And so I kind of thought, maybe there's something wrong, but this is kind of one-sided. However, the other two were families that had used the MTM broker system in place. And their concerns were, frankly, more than that of the transporter that I had talked to before that. And I was pretty dissatisfied with what I heard for vulnerable adults in these two cases that were given rides that were inappropriate, not station to station like they should have been, incidents that basically were not nice, and I don't think I'm going to go through them here. And I came away from that thinking we went from a broken system to an even worse system. And so I do agree with Senator Higgins' bill, because I think what we've done has made it even worse. I think the department could easily put in place some of the things, even like this gentleman is talking about, the chain, what'd you call it, chain of custody, some things like that. And we can work with it, but I don't think we need this broker. And when you talk about the client's issues being with the drivers or with the transporters, I'm sorry. That's MTM's problem. They should not be using transporters that are not qualified and don't know what they're doing. That's the end of the subject. We shouldn't be hiring someone that doesn't know enough to hire reliable subcontractors. That's an MTM issue. So I just have big issues with this whole broker transportation thing. And Senator Higgins, while I'm on it, the only part of your bill that I disagree with is I don't think this is the appropriate time to raise those rates, and I think they were adequate before you changed them in your bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bergen, as always, the bill will go to Senator Berglund's committee, and she'll decide, the committee that she chairs will decide about that issue. But we thought it was worth having a conversation about, and we'll take that to the Finance Division. And I know finances are tight, so we'll compete with a lot of other really good things as well.
Senator Corey.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm just wondering if I heard a lot of talk of fraud, and I'm just wondering if the department has heard of any fraud on behalf of MTM at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corey, no, we have not heard of any fraud on the part of MTM.
Mr. Chairman, I've been informed a long time ago that MTM was kicked out of Missouri and was fined, I think, $1.9 million. For fraud. Has the department been made aware of that?
We are aware of a settlement that MTM did in Missouri. There was no fraud found or alleged in that case. It was a situation where there was a contract interpretation between the state and MTM, and they did give $2 million back to the state, but there mm-hmm. was no never any alleged fraud or fraud found in that case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it just appears to me that it. Pardon? other states too. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, it just appears to me that the broker thing is not working, and I personally will be doing everything I can to get this changed. It's just not working, and I don't understand why the department is bucking this, but that I believe they're wrong. So,
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Senator Marty and Senator Higgins. I can shorten my remarks because I wholeheartedly support everything that Senator Wiergan just stated. And I think this is an excellent opportunity for the Minnesota State Senate to exercise some continuous improvement. And it seems like a ripe opportunity to do that. Overall, when we talk about health care costs and health care reform in the state of Minnesota, we should, I think, important components of those discussions are inefficiencies, administrative cost, and quality. Seems to me that this bill provides a tool that we can address some of those things. And I guess what I find most interesting about this entire discussion is that this bill is really about the people. This bill and this this whole concept of the transportation shouldn't be about justifying the broker or making life easier for the department. So, Senator Higgins, you have my full support, and thank you for your work on this.
Higgins.
Mr. Chair, if there are no other comments from the committee, I'll move that Senate File 570 as amended be recommended to pass.
There may be somebody else who wanted to speak to the bill.
Shoot.
there was another person, Elena Macia. No?
Anybody else?
Okay, if not.
Okay. Mr. Chair, maybe whoever it was, they decided to quit while they were way ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill. It needs to go to finance.
Senator Higgins moves Senate File 570 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion of that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Prettner-Solin will take your bill.
So, Madam Chair and members, I do have some handouts. If somebody will come in and distribute those, please. Members, Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to bring to your attention an important issue in Greater Minnesota regarding the declining number of family practice physicians. Currently, SMDC alone, which one of our members here is representing that institution, is actively recruiting 35 primary care physicians to meet the needs of providing primary care for Duluth and surrounding residents. The Duluth Medical School produces more family doctors for Greater Minnesota than any other residency program in the state. However, state funding for the Duluth program has not kept pace with inflation, requiring the local hospitals, St. Luke's and St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, to make significant financial contributions to the support of the programs and the educational process. This places the hospitals in a financial hardship given the recent and ongoing reductions to hospital reimbursements and the high degree of uninsured and underinsured patients in the Twin Ports area. And I would like to identify a situation in northeastern Minnesota, which I think is also true in a few other areas, that is a bit unique, though, to many of the hospitals in Minnesota, and that is that in northeastern Minnesota, there are a number of MA patients that come to us from northeastern or northwestern Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, actually, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Now, there is money. It's the Family Practice Residency Program that we're concerned about at this time. And as I said, we are having declining financial contributions from the state. Some of the money that comes to that program is through the MERC program, which is for medical education. And the formula that that is based on medical education as well as MA days. And what it doesn't take into account is the significant number of days of volume that comes from Wisconsin and Michigan. So in discussing this problem both with the Commissioner of Health and with Senator Berglund, it was suggested that the formula, which currently is based on MA payables, instead be rewritten to be based on MA billables, which would then take into account the volume of service provided for Michigan and Wisconsin. I find out, actually, that the bill as I have it drafted and written for you may be very difficult for the department to implement, but they do understand the concept and are willing to work with us in helping us to incorporate these suggestions into a new formula. And it just so happens that the federal government is requiring that the formula be changed and be directed more toward the MA volume of the hospitals rather than the medical education. Now, the situation in Duluth, as I was saying about the residency program, is that the hospitals receive the MERC payments, but then they turn them over to the residency program in support of that program. And we are looking for ways to continue to support that program. And as the gentleman with me here today will explain, provide a significant number of residents, family practice residents for the state, and we have declining dollars. So although this bill before you today may not be the specific vehicle to address the issue, I do want to bring to your attention the situation in Greater Minnesota and pursue avenues to address the growing problem. And with me today to provide you with additional information is Dr. Tom Day, Duluth Family Medicine Residency Program Director, and Mr. John Strange, CEO of St. Luke's Hospital Duluth, also the president of DGMIC, which is the Duluth General Education Medical Council, and Dr. Terry Clark from the SMDC Health System. And they will briefly address the committee, and then we will stand for any questions that you might have. And who is going to start? I guess Dr. Clark will start.
Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Yes.
The chair of the committee is gone, so I'm chairing now.
My name's Terry Clark. I'm a physician at the Duluth Clinic, which is part of the St. Mary's Duluth Clinic Health System based in Duluth. And for those of you who may not be familiar, SMDC operates 4 hospitals, 18 clinics, has 400 doctors. And for us, having primary care physicians is extremely important, as is medical education in general. You'll be hearing more and more about the importance of patients having a medical home, meaning a relationship with a physician they know and a physician who provides continuity of care, and through that continuity, trust develops over time. And there's ample evidence that trust in the relationship between patient and doctor saves money. So as we worry about healthcare costs, having education of primary care physicians is a very significant cost-saving investment. As Senator Brettner Sullivan mentioned, in Duluth, medical education consists of the medical school, the family practice residency program, and a variety of programs for physicians who are already in practice. The medical school in Duluth graduates 50 students per year. That's the same number as Mayo, but obviously a smaller number than the Twin Cities. What makes the program in Duluth different is that the medical school, 68% of their graduates go into primary care, the very thing we need. Half of those graduates end up in towns of 20,000 population or smaller, providing the resource we need in rural Minnesota. The family practice residency program completes training of 10 physicians per year, and Dr. Day will say much more about that. SMDC supports the ongoing education of physicians who are already in practice. We provide over 10,000 hours of continuing medical education credits per year for doctors who are in practice. We support the medical school not only with lectures and clinical mentoring and bedside teaching, but with dollars, with a $1.2 million endowment for a professor of molecular biology at the medical school. And we've chosen that because that's the closest link between basic science and clinical practice. We also support the family practice residency in three ways, again, with teaching, mentoring of the family practice residents, but also by passing through $600,000 a year of MRC money that comes from the state, as well as $900,000 of funds that come to the hospital from Medicare that we pass through to support the family practice residency program. As Senator Pretner-Solan mentioned, a large portion of the medical assistance population we serve in Duluth comes from Wisconsin and a small amount from Michigan. There's a formula for how the MRC money gets distributed, but it does not take into account the services provided to residents from Wisconsin. For us, that's 26% of all the medical assistance care we provide actually goes to people from Wisconsin. We would submit that should influence the formula, it should influence the support of education for primary care docs in a way that it doesn't at the present time. I would submit that the training of primary care physicians is a valuable investment for the state of Minnesota, and clearly this program is a key source of docs for small towns, not just in a community like Duluth.
Thank you.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Dr. Thomas Day will address us next.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senators, the Duluth Family Practice Residency Program has been in Duluth since 1974 and has graduated family doctors every year since 1977. Over that time, it has become the largest single source of family doctors for greater Minnesota. We have 256 graduates, 85% of them practice in towns smaller than 20,000. It's really not just a Duluth or a Northeast Minnesota benefit from this program, but all of Minnesota. Over the course of that time, the programs in the metro area have also produced some graduates for greater Minnesota, but the vast majority are produced in Duluth and to some extent in St. Cloud and Mankato. Oh, I have a graph in the purple folder I gave you showing the funding for the program over the past 20 years. The state funding has been static, and it's been picked up primarily by the hospitals. Over the past 7 years, the MRC money has taken the place of state funding that has come to us through the university. That MRC money is now threatened by the changes in the federal formula. And as Dr. Clark has mentioned, that formula that we've been operating under for the past number of years has never taken into consideration the amount of care that's provided to Medicaid recipients from Wisconsin and Michigan. The funding for the Duluth Family Practice Residency comes primarily from the hospitals locally, also from some patient care services for those patients who have sources of funding. I have another bar graph in your paperwork that shows over time we have attracted an increasing number of patients with no source of insurance. Greater than 50% of our accounts receivable now are for patients who have no insurance and essentially no method of paying their medical bills. So the support of the hospitals keeps our program alive and keeps us producing family doctors who are appropriately trained to practice in the smaller communities around Minnesota. One last mention about that. The Center for Rural Health in Duluth tracks current openings for family doctors around Minnesota. There are 94 open positions for family doctors outside of the metro area and essentially just a few within the metro area. So the demand is very great in greater Minnesota, and those of you who represent districts outside of the metro area understand that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And next is Mr. John Strange.
Thank you. John Strange from St. Luke's Hospital. St. Luke's and SMDC work quite closely together in support of education in our community. At any point in time, St. Luke's has over 300 students working within our facility, taking their clinicals and taking classes. Part of our program is also involved with the Family Practice Residency Program. There is a tremendous shortage of physicians looming now and into their future. Currently, between the two systems, we are looking for 135 physicians for our region, and that's just the northern part of Minnesota. I currently have more open positions for physicians than I have for RNs, and we continue to struggle with the physician population. In order to get people in to be seen in a timely basis to catch their illnesses quickly, we need a good network of family practice physicians. And without the residency program, we're going to see that supply of physicians continue to decline. I did give you an exhibit from St. Luke's, and one of our concerns about basing thing on payment or payables is the fact that in 2005, we had $38 million in charges for Medicaid recipients from Minnesota. Our payments were set $14,700,000. In 2006, we actually had $42 million, or a $4 million increase, and our payments went down to $14,001,000. So we lost $600,000 in payments on our Medicare recipient, our Medicaid recipients. In addition, we have seen a number of patients from the outstates or Wisconsin, which are come to our facility for Medicaid. Our level is not as high as SMDC. We did see $4,400,000 worth of charges in 2005 and a decline to $3,400,000 in 2006. I'd like to tell you that this was because of an increased payer mix on our part, but rather we think it was because people lost eligibility in Wisconsin, which has much tougher criteria than Minnesota. And we continue to see these patients seeking help but not being able to pay or have no coverage. Our bad debt in 2002 was $2 million. This last year, our bad debt was $7.6 million, a $5 million increase in less than 4 years. We continue to see the pressure on the healthcare systems. At the same time, we know we need to support medical education. We feel it's our duty. People took time and effort and money to support us as we got our education, and some of us learned slowly. And the new physicians require the same thing. So the health systems have gotten together, worked closely with the family practice residency and the university to support the medical school, and will continue to as long as we have the wherewithal to do so. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, perhaps the best thing would be to take questions if you like at this time. I do know that the department may want to make some comments about how the bill is currently written.
Do we have anybody from the department, Senator, that is here that wishes to testify? Okay. I don't think there is anybody. Are there any questions from the members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Pretner-Solon. And I want to understand how this is working. Is this a reallocation of the way that the funding is currently done. In other words, by changing the formula to use the charges submitted rather than the revenue received, does that alter the distribution of the support to other medical school institutions? I'm just trying to understand what the effect of this is with the other schools.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, actually there are two things happening at the same time. One of them is that there's a directive from the federal government to change the way that we distribute the MERC funds to align it more with medical assistance payments than with medical education. At the same time, what we're doing is saying that there is a large volume of, because there is such an emphasis on the medical assistance service, that it should be taken into account that we also serve a high number of people from bordering states. And that might include Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota. And so as this bill is actually written, it's not workable, quite frankly. But it's the concept that we would like to advance into the finance division, that we want to be acknowledged for the fact that there is a volume of care that is provided to medical assistance clients from outside of the Minnesota boundaries.
And Madam Chair, and thank
Senator
you. I guess I would agree. I think that makes sense to try to account for that. I just wasn't clear on how this was going to do that.
Yeah. It doesn't, quite frankly. No.
Thank you. Senator Morgan. Senator Worgen, did you have a question? No? Does anybody have a question? Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I realize this needs a lot of work, but I would like it to move to the Finance Division. And so at this time, I move that Senate File 1593 be approved and re-referred to the Division on Finance.
Okay. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund, we're going to go to you. Senator Marty's not here.
Just one? It's an aspirin one? Yep. That's really fun.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, because I have a couple of witnesses, one from out of town and another one who's leaving town, and they cannot come back tonight. So I'd like to start, first of all, by offering a couple of author's amendments. The first one would be an A1 amendment.
They are being distributed now, so...
And the second one is an A3 amendment. They could be distributed at the same time.
An A2 and an A3. An A2.
A2 and A2. A2. And
A3. I must have an old one. Maybe I could get the A2.
Yep. There she goes.
Madam Chair, the A2 amendment is an amendment that was requested by the Board of Medical Practice, and it simply indicates that the data registration system that we would be creating in this bill would not automatically come to the board for their information or disciplinary action.
Are there any questions for Senator Berglund on the amendment? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Go ahead.
And then, Madam Chair and members, I move the A3 amendment. And the A3 amendment would provide in the bill that we'd be dealing with both Schedule 2 and Schedule 3 drugs, and then would also include language that would... require standards accepted by the National and International Pain Management Associations to be the standard in the bill instead of just generally recognized standards.
Okay. Any discussion on this amendment? Any questions?
If not, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill would allow the state to apply for federal funding that's available to create a substances reporting system. This bill would do it through the Board of Pharmacy, and we've worked with the board on it. There has been money every year in the federal budget for this, and there's $9.9 million in the president's budget that's proposed for this year for this, starting up these kinds of programs. It would be a real-time electronic reporting system, and we can do real-time because all of our pharmacies today have electronic systems because of Part D that allow for real-time communications. The outline of the bill provides a lot of information to the Board of Pharmacy in setting up the program in terms of things that need to be in the system because of the federal requirements, and then other things to make sure that we protect confidentiality. The bill would not allow the disclosure of a physician's name unless the physician had given their permission. The only people that can enter or get information from the system are either a patient can get information about themselves, or a physician that is treating that patient can get information about that patient, or law enforcement can get information from the system if they have a warrant in order to get the information. The bill is really designed to be a useful tool to physicians in terms of making sure that their patients, when they prescribe a Schedule II or Schedule III controlled substance, that they are not receiving the prescriptions from another physician, and that they are that the treating physician is not then duplicating that prescription. The reason the federal government has been providing money to get these kind of systems started is because there is quite a bit of information that leads one to believe that we have a system that will that we have a system going on in the United States today where people buy these, get these prescriptions, and then they sell the pills on the street. OxyContin's about $40 or $45 a pill on the street. So then even if medical assistance or your health plan or whatever isn't paying for a second prescription, you have generated enough revenue to pay for many more prescriptions. And so it's part, the purpose of the bill then is to provide physicians a tool so that they know that they are not providing more prescriptions to a person than they really need in regard to these medications that are habit-forming. We do know that there is information about the fact that other states, when they create these kinds of systems, that then the problem is shifted to another state that is a bordering state. And we do know that Iowa has a system like this that's been established, and that North and South Dakota are now establishing their own systems. So those are states that border us on three sides. I have handed out an article that was in a recent magazine of the state legislatures that shows the problem that that is on a national level, and how that this problem of people getting prescriptions from physicians in order to access these drugs when they're maybe abusing the drug or selling the drug is not the only problem. And I certainly be the first to say that that's not the only problem in illicit drug use, but it is a big problem. And it is a problem that we, with this legislation, could manage to control a little better than we do. I have a snapshot for you in terms of handout materials from the Department of Human Services with our own patients. And that snapshot shows us that in calendar years 2005 and 2006, of the 450 people that we have on our restricted fee-for-service program, that means that we believe that they may be abusing drugs, so they are restricted to one physician and one hospital. There are 450 of those, and of those in 2005 and 2006, 65 died in that two-year period. Not all of the causes of death were known, but 18 were related to prescription drug overdoses, and that was 31%. And we have also evidence to show that some 3,000 people in the regular fee-for-service program that are not in the restricted program also have had incidences with either being poisoned or dying from an overdose of prescription drugs. So this, we know that people die. We know that people are being admitted to emergency rooms because of drug poisoning. This bill will provide physicians a tool to help reduce those kinds of incidences from occurring. And so, Madam Chair, I'd like you to take the witnesses that we have to testify on the bill. If we could do that now, I think that would be good.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Yes. Excuse me. Okay. Sorry. I just got a note. I got distracted for a moment. Okay. So we have the witnesses here. And if you could please introduce yourselves and just decide how you want to go. Who wants
Madam
to start?
Chair, I'm
go
Dr.
ahead.
David Schultz. I'm a full-time pain specialist physician.
Madam Chair, I'm Dr. Darren Gersh. I'm a family physician in Albany, Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead and start.
Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for the opportunity. As a pain specialist physician, I'm prescribing these powerful narcotic pain medications on a daily basis. And as pain specialists, we operate in an environment where we have increasingly powerful designer narcotic pain medicines to prescribe to our patients, and these drugs are often life-saving to our patients who need them. On the other hand, they are easily divertible and abusable. And so there's an increasing problem regionally and in the country of increasing abuse and diversion of prescription drugs at the same time that abuse of heroin and street drugs is declining. So what we find in the pain clinic is that we have patients, about 20% is estimated by certain studies, that come into the pain clinic under false pretenses to get me to write them a prescription for something like OxyContin. And OxyContin sells for, as Senator Berglund was saying, a dollar a milligram on the street. So if I give someone 100 tablets in a bottle of 40 milligram tablets, that may be several thousand dollars of street value for a criminal to sell on the street. So you can see the incentive that criminals have to come in and get the drugs from me and then go next door and get them from some other doctor and then go down the street and get them from another doctor. And there is really no way that I can determine whether a patient who I am about to write a prescription for has received these drugs from someone else. That creates a very difficult situation for me because I have to kind of go on blind faith. And if I give these drugs to the wrong person, they wind up in the community in the hands of teenagers and others. And they're very dangerous and potentially deadly in the wrong hands. I think that also puts a chill on family practitioners who may want to prescribe to a patient, but they can't really look into the record and see if that patient is getting drugs from others. The sole purpose of this database, in my opinion, is to allow me a tool that I can use to look at that patient and make sure that it's a legitimate patient and that they're not getting doctor shopping and getting drugs from other sources. I don't intended or wanted to be used to look at doctors' prescribing habits. That's not its intention. And I'll just close there.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm a family physician in Albany, Minnesota, which is a town of 1,500 people just west of St. Cloud. We do have an emergency room, and we are situated right on Interstate 94. We have several patients who will stop within our emergency room requesting pain medications for various ailments. And to the best of our ability, we try and find out if these people truly have problems or not, but pain is a very subjective complaint, and sometimes it's very difficult to try and tell whether a person truly is having as much pain as they have. Often we give pain medicines or we won't give pain medicines based on what we can find, knowing sometimes we might be giving pain medicines to people who are going to just continue on down the interstate and try and get them from another emergency room, and there is really no way for us to try and find out who's doing that versus the ones who truly need the medications. I see this bill as being helpful in my practice in a few different areas. One I already mentioned in the emergency room, not only to try and stop the people who are abusing the medications, but also to help the ones that truly need it. 2 years ago, it was so bad in our emergency room that we finally adopted a policy that we do not give out narcotics unless we see an obvious injury. In other words, someone has an obvious fracture, someone has an obvious problem, and that actually has decreased the amount of drug seekers we've had in our ER because word gets out, don't go to our ER. But we still get people trying. The other thing is in my office, I will have people coming in with chronic pain problems, whether it would be back pain, migraines, that sort of thing. And as a family physician in a rural area, we often don't have all the support we could need for chronic pain, and we end up doing a lot of it on our own. And it would be very helpful to know which patients are truly setting up a contract with me, truly wanting to have their pain controlled, versus the ones that are going to seven different doctors and getting their pain medicines from seven different people. And finally, it would be very helpful from my standpoint for my own patients, because if I know I have a patient that I'm currently taking care of and I see them on the registry as going to three other doctors, then the next time they come in to see me, I'm going to confront them with that, try and help them if I can, and at the very minimum, not give them any more medications. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll be present.
Thank you.
Please. Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak. As a nurse practitioner in a pain clinic, one of my primary responsibilities is managing medications for patients. So I often do medication refills. We make every effort to treat non-cancer pain with various therapies, which certainly include physical therapy, pool therapy. We do injections. We have a good behavioral program. But many people need some sort of a bridge between resolution of their problem and when they first come in the clinic, and thus we might prescribe a short-acting pain medication for them. In the last 4 to 5 months, I've had two very legitimate appearing patients, both with MRI scans that show some degenerative changes that would lead one to think they have pain, who participated in our programs. But some 3 to 4 months later, I get a report from an insurance company that shows that they're getting similar prescriptions to what I'm prescribing from other doctors or nurse practitioners or PA, and they clearly had not disclosed that to me. So I don't have a way to sort those folks out other than to see that they're participating and making an effort in their own rehab. And even that's hard to track, but with electronics, we're doing better at it. And I think one of the spinoffs of this is family practice physicians who see the bulk of patients that need care, and certainly emergency room physicians as well, are very reluctant to prescribe when a patient asks for any type of a opioid-type drug, those that are abusable. So they will sometimes tell patients they're just going to have to live with it or they're just going to have to go somewhere else. That puts more pressure on our clinic. And really, I think those are many times those are cases that the physician locally can manage their patient but they're afraid to do so, and they have no way of checking good reliability of the patient in terms of their past history of prescribing. And these are just two of the reasons that I'm here to request your support of this NASPR bill. I think it will make prescribing for patients who are legitimate safer. I think it will make the right prescriptions more available to patients when they really truly do need them. And it'll make physicians more comfortable in prescribing. It'll also decrease the likelihood that the drug will be diverted somewhere, possibly sold, and potentially could lead to an emergency room visit for a person who's not taking the drug for medical purposes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, to either of the witnesses, in the last couple of years, we've had a proliferation of minute clinic type of places, you know, where you can go, rather than your own physician. Do you know if they prescribe the Schedule 2s or Schedule 3s, or do they, I would think that they would be another way that people could have access that their own physician wouldn't know, but in the times that I've thought about them, I've thought they tended to be about kind of more minor ailments and things, and maybe it's not relevant. And I wondered if anybody knew.
I don't know myself. As I mentioned, I do believe the clinics are more geared towards acute care, acute respiratory illnesses, that sort of thing, maybe a sprained ankle.
I'm Dr. Thomas Cohn. I'm associate of Dr. Schultz with MAPS Clinic. I'm a pain physician. I've been in practice for 20 years. As far as the minute clinics, I don't know for sure, but they may give very short prescriptions of short-acting painkillers such as Vicodin, which is one of the number one abused drugs in the country. And it would be only for 10 to 15 pills, but not any significant number. But those are still amounts that can get out into the community and be diverted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Hahn.
excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, Senator Berglund, would this reporting system apply to the use of medical marijuana if that were to become a part of the things that get adopted this year in the health bill?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I am not familiar with where that would fall on the schedule if it did become a drug that could be prescribed by physicians. I'm sorry.
And Madam Chair and Senator, the reason
this bill deals with Schedule 2 and Schedule 3. There are others in the schedule. We're trying not to get everything into this kind of a registry system, just the drugs that we know are being abused by being sold on the street.
And Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I appreciate that, and I just recall the discussion we had about medical marijuana, and it seems that that's a drug that gets commonly abused, and it seems ironic that we would be focusing on prescription drugs and saying we need to make sure that those are controlled more stringently and that we create databases of who's using them and who's prescribing them so that we know. But at the same time, a Schedule 1 substance like marijuana, we're not going to put it into this regimen, and I would think at least we'd want to make sure that as a Schedule 1 substance should be also required that people who are given the, and I don't think we prescribe it under the bill that we passed, but there ought to be at least some language to say we should keep track of those people.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, if that bill would pass, then you could propose adding it to this if I can get this one passed. I've been trying to get this one passed for a little while now, so I think it would be a good tool, and your comments point out how it could be used in a favorable manner to make sure people aren't abusing any schedule drugs.
I want to tell members of the committee I had Senator Berglund go because she has some witnesses who have to leave now, and I also have some who have to leave before the evening hearing who came from northern Minnesota. So I do want to have a few minutes for testimony on that before we adjourn.
I'm done, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, it's, if we have time to vote on this quickly, but we need 10 minutes for that. Did you have any?
That's okay.
Is there, sorry, I just came in the middle of it. You moved.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move then that Senate File 714 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And, Mr. Chairman, if it's possible for the paperwork to get done, this bill is scheduled on Thursday in that committee.
On Senator Berglund's motion, is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Now we're going to take witnesses on Senate File 1535. There are a couple of people from northern Minnesota who I plan to get in. And while they are coming up, just because we're not going to deal with it, I do have the A3 amendment. No,
A1
amendment to that. I believe it's, pardon? We will incorporate the amendment. I mean, we will take up the bill with that amendment acted on later today. But in the meantime, I would like to get the testimony from those who have to leave. So welcome to the committee, and if you could just please identify yourself and then go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Kevin Nendick. I'm the president of the United Steelworkers Local 9460. We're the healthcare division of the United Steelworkers. I represent about 2,600 members that work exclusively in healthcare, ranging from hospital settings, clinic settings, as well as nursing home and nursing care facility settings.
Just go ahead with your testimony as quick as you can, because we only have a few more minutes.
Thank you. I'll be real brief. The focus of our bill is asking that there be required safety training for nursing care workers on the subject of behavioral disorders. The natural business evolution has resulted in dramatic changes within the nursing care industry in recent years. No longer are these facilities caring primarily just for elderly residents. They now include wide ranges of ages from residents in their 20s and on up. Also includes residents suffering from a variety of behavioral disorders and conditions. Presently, safety training for direct care staff on the subject of behavioral disorders among nursing care facility residents is for the most part non-existent. The need for the safety training specific to behavioral disorders is critical and necessary. It's critical for the safety of the residents of the facility. It's critical for the safety of the direct care staff. And it's also critical for the safety of the facilities themselves and for the delivering the excellence of care at those facilities. Unfortunately, we've experienced great resistance from administrations of many nursing care facilities when we've attempted to secure safety training specific to behavioral disorders. It seems that unless they are required by statute to provide safety training on behavioral disorders, the vast majority of nursing care facilities refuse to provide this or even entertain providing this. That's why we have brought this bill here before you today, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Nendick. Ms. Godin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is LaVon Godin. I'm a CNA of 30 years at a nursing home up in Hibbing. And over the years, I've seen a vast change in our clientele at the homes. And as Kevin had said, we have varying ages from 20 all the way up to the elderly, suffering from personality disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar. We also have a sex offender. We get the homeless. And we have alcohol and chemical dependencies. We are expected to address all of these people's needs without any training. All of these people need to be dressed for their specific disorder, not clumped together. And what we're finding is the effect is These people are getting hostile towards us. We're not dealing with them correctly because we don't know what we're doing. And it's causing a lot of problems in the workplace. And like I said, oftentimes the behaviors are amplified by our behaviors because we are ignorant. So, and it is a losing situation for all of us, for the residents that we care for and for the staff. And achieving this, getting the training, we hope that the clients will be happier, we will be happier. And it will help with less injuries in the workplace, less workman's comp, which is a plus, retention of staff, and we all know that nursing home CNAs is a very short staffed right now. So it is very important to their emotional well-being that if we are to care for these people, that we are trained properly to care for these people. Thank you.
Ms. Godin, we're dealing with the same thing with like law enforcement when they're dealing with mentally ill people. Sometimes, as you pointed out, the improper treatment makes them act up more because it's the wrong response. We're trying to deal with that with law enforcement, making sure they have the training. Did you have any, before you started dealing with people with schizophrenia or whatever, did you have any training related to how to deal with it or?
No. In the facility in-house, I have had no training. Personally, I have gone to college and have worked towards a bachelor's degree in psychology, so I'm more aware of what their needs are. But a lot of people that I work with have no idea. They don't even understand the disorders. They couldn't even tell you what a personality disorder is. And that's sad that you have somebody taking care of somebody who doesn't even know what they suffer from.
And in that case, something that the nature of their illness makes them act up in such a way that if you don't understand it, it gets much worse.
Yes, it does. We aggravate the situations many times, and I have seen it in the workplace.
In the facility you work at right now, are there a number of people with serious persistent mental illness who are difficult to deal with that you would need training for? Like right now, how big is the facility?
Our facility right now holds approximately 75 people when we're full. Approximately 25% of our clients suffer from one of these above, of these disorders. And you can be 25 years old suffering from this disorder or 80 years old.
Are there any questions from the committee for either of the witnesses? We will have to deal with this bill tonight and any other bills we didn't get to, I guess my other bill. We will have to do, but I appreciate your coming down here for this very much, and I'm glad you were able to stay around for testimony now. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could we meet earlier, Mr. Chairman?
In terms of,
I don't know, 6:30, I don't know if members of the committee will be able to meet at 6 so we can leave earlier.
I'm game with that. Other members of the committee?
About 5:30.
5:30 will be excellent.
We
were here until 11:30.
5:30?
5:30.
We just have the two bills?
Three or four, five bills. About 6 o'clock, is it compromise?
5:30, is that okay?
I'd love it. Okay,
5:30, but we'll leave at 8:30. 5:30.
We will, Ms. Freeman, I know you're very concerned about the A1 amendment, if it will make you more comfortable if we adopt the A1. Okay, we'll address it. Okay, you'll be around. Thank you. I didn't want to have to do that for an amendment that I think we'll adopt right away. Any further discussion? If not, we will adjourn until
5:30.
Recess
until 5:30, and Senate Council is excused. If they can't get everything done by then, we'll work around it. So. Thank you. With that, the meeting is in recess. We will.
So your hand told me about the.
But I don't know.
Oh,
I will talk very slowly.
It's not my bill. I was.
7:14.
Yeah. It's patient how much of this you were actually using.
What is your name?
Rich.